Welcome to this Q&A on Palestine. I've been working with Diego, Thomas, Max, and Sophia to get the show up. We will start recording the show, which will come out weekly again at the end of July. These are a few of the authors and books we'll be focusing on. We'll do one show on Gideon Levy's book, The Killing of Gaza, Reports on a Catastrophe. We'll do a show on Peter Shambrook's Policy of Defeat, Britain and Palestine, 1914 to 1939. We'll do Peter Obern's book, The Fate of Abraham, Why the West is Wrong About Islam. This is a classic by Eugene Rogan, The Fall of the Ottomans. We will do Memoirs of an Arab Jew, another classic by Avi Shlam, and Stories from the Center of the World, that's new Middle East fiction. And then Ilan Pape's new book, which is Lobbying for Zionism. So I've got, this is all my summer reading here. And we'll start putting those shows out, hopefully, the last week of July or the beginning of August. And then they'll run weekly as they did when I had a show on The Real News. And then later on, before that on RT, and before that on Telesur. So this is from Joseph Woolslayer. Who will stop this genocide? America can't, because the American government is infiltrated by the Israel lobby. Most governments can't without risking regional war. So who will stop this genocide? How will it end? Well, that is the question, of course, because there doesn't seem to be a force that can make it end. I was just came back from Cairo and was speaking with the former Minister of Information for Gamal Abdel Nasser, and he made a very prescient point. He said it's not that Israel is strong, it's that the Arab states are weak. Under Nasser, under the old non-aligned movement with Tito and Nehru, there would have been a very robust response internationally, and in particular within the Arab world, especially because Nasser could really organize the Arab street. So it's not going to come out of the Arab world. The United States is not going to halt the weapon shipments and intelligence support and everything else. I don't see that there's any force that the only state that has made a meaningful response to the genocide is Yemen. Yemen has disrupted maritime traffic, but that was essentially compensated for with the opening of a land corridor by Saudi Arabia and Jordan to get all sorts of supplies, consumer goods, everything else into Israel. I don't see any force out there. I mean, the question is whether the Israeli government, which has a very fractious, Netanyahu is a very fractious coalition, the question is, does that government collapse? But I don't see anything politically within Israel that would replace Netanyahu. It would be a government might come into being, which is more palatable to the United States rhetorically. But I don't at this point see any forces within Israel that have any intention of stopping this second Nakba for the Palestinians. I mean, it's all, and Joe Sacco and I are planning to do a book, of course, on Gaza when this ends. But we don't know physically where we're going to be, where the Palestinians will be. Egypt has been quite, and in particular, the Egyptian military has made it very clear to the president of Egypt, Sisi, that they are not going to come over the border from Rafah into the Sinai, into the Egyptian Sinai. So it's a question I think all of us are asking. How is it going to end? You know, we know what Israel's intent is. Will Israel's intent be achieved? We, you know, I don't think Israel knows. I don't think at this point anyone can answer that question. This is from Miguel. Is the collapse of the U.S. empire a prerequisite for Israel to stop its genocide? Would Israel's economy have enough resources and time to build up a local arms industry in such a case? Well, yes. So that's, of course, a crucial point because I think it's 68% of munitions Israel's depleted their own stockpiles come from the United States. the collapse of the U.S. empire will have a significant, very dramatic effect on Israel, because the collapse of the U.S. empire means the collapse of the U.S. dollar. The day the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, and of course, seeing Russia and China work very hard to achieve that end, that will be catastrophic for the American empire, because we won't be able to fund it. People won't buy our debt. And it will be catastrophic for Israel. But when that's going to happen, I don't know. Would Israel's economy have enough resources? I can't answer that question, except that right now the Israeli military is completely interdependent on the U.S. arms industry, and without the U.S. arms industry, would not be able to continue to prosecute this genocide. This is from Bernadine. How many countries do you think will cease all recognition of Israel by stopping trade, diplomatic relations, etc.? And can that, if enough do that, lead Israel to ceasing to be? We can't even get the Arab states to recall their ambassadors. We can't even get the Arab states to embrace boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So at this point, I don't see that there is, and certainly within Europe, within the industrial North, there's active complicity by the UK, by Germany, and all these other countries. I mean, there have been some countries like Norway that have stood up and refused to ship arms to Israel, but there's no significant movement diplomatically to isolate Israel. This is Phoebe. Do you think there might be ways we might kindle awareness? Oh, I just lost that one. Yeah. Do you think there might be ways we might kindle awareness of the mental health conditions that drive settler colonialism and genocide? People with unhealed trauma, which they're not conscious of, can sometimes do terrible things to others and to themselves based on lies they believe as a result of their unfaced trauma. So most of the settlers in the West Bank, from my experience, come from countries like the United States. There may be historical trauma in terms of the Holocaust, but I think that many writers on Israel, including Ilan Papi and others, would cite the indoctrination of the Israeli state, and in particular the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, which starts basically in primary school. And that it's that indoctrination which leads to this embrace of an apartheid system and dehumanization of the Palestinians. Not that trauma, historical trauma, doesn't play a part, but indoctrination is key towards essentially building a society where the military is idolized, mythologized, and the Palestinians are reduced to kind of subhumans. Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath, I think, does a pretty good job of peeling back the layers of modern Israel and exploring all of those issues. Is the Hamas charter actually genocidal, as many Zionists often say? Yeah, the original document by Hamas calls for the eradication of the Jewish state. I think the question that many people would raise is whether it was a charter and whether it was superseded by later documents. I think it's important to remember that Hamas comes out of Gaza. It is, and 75% of the people in Gaza are refugees, or at this point, the descendant of refugees. So when Arafat signed the Oslo Peace Agreement, he essentially gave up the right of return, the right of refugees to return to their original homes inside historic Palestine. And that alienated most residents in Gaza from Fatah, from the PLO. And so what we saw was the rise of this militant movement, Hamas, which spoke for those who were dispossessed by the Zionist state and had been abandoned by the PLO and Fatah. So that issue of the right of return is key to understanding where Palestinians in Gaza are coming from and key to understanding the popular support that Hamas has. How much popular support Hamas has at the moment, I don't know. I was speaking to Palestinian friends of mine in Egypt, and part of their frustration is that Hamas disarmed the Palestinians. It used to be that everybody had an AK-47 in their bedroom, and disarmed the population, and they're in the tunnels, and the rest of the Palestinians are largely defenseless and, of course, exposed to this genocidal assault. This is from Chinchilla. Discussing the issue of Israel immediately triggers hysterical reactions and accusations of anti-Semitism. How can we even discuss the topic? Well, the accusing somebody of being an anti-Semite or accusing them of being a racist is a way to shut down discussion, and that's its intent. So it's very difficult at this point for the Zionists and the Zionist lobby to defend what they're doing, and that's why they're making such an active effort to silence and attack critics. Within universities, over 2,000 students have been arrested. You have all sorts of academics and others who have been pushed aside and marginalized and assaulted by the Zionist lobby. You now have I think Columbia University is going to institute a program where students have to take, all students have to take some kind of a course on quote-unquote anti-Semitism, where, of course, any criticism of the Israeli state is equated with anti-Semitism. What are your thoughts on Norm Finkelstein's analogy comparing October 7th to the Nat Turner slave rebellion? Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I think that is exactly the right analogy, because when Nat Turner organized the slave rebellion, they killed every white person they saw. Remember, the people who burst through the security barrier in Gaza, many of them had never left Gaza. They had spent their entire life in a concentration camp. And the only Israelis or Jews that they had ever encountered were trying to kill them often, or certainly oppress them. So it doesn't, you know, I've said it many times, to understand is not to condone. But I think that analogy is a good one. I think that's precisely what we saw was a slave revolt. This is from Adele. My question is about Palestinian Jews who lived in pre-1948 Palestine. Have they faced ostracism, considering that the conflict centers on land rather than religion? Have they all become Zionists? So the turn of the century, 1914, roughly, about 6% of the population of historic Palestine was Jewish, and most of those Jews lived in Jerusalem. And then we saw the influx of Zionist settlers in the interwar years, the 1930s, and then the huge influx of Zionist settlers, almost exclusively from Europe, after World War II. Many cases, of course, they were dispossessed by the Holocaust. Poland, which had a huge Jewish population, when Jews tried to return to Poland, their houses had been occupied by non-Jewish Poles. There was a book, Neighbors, which does a pretty good job of explaining the climate in the aftermath of World War II and how it was almost impossible for the few Jews who survived to return to where they had once lived. The intent from the beginning among the Zionist settlers, and that's all within the historical record, whether that's Jabotinsky or Ben-Gurion or anyone else, was to dispossess the Palestinians of their land. There were many tactics that they use. Sometimes they bought the land. Of course, in 1948, they used terror to displace roughly 750,000 Palestinians from the land. But Zionism and there was always a great deal of tension between Zionism and traditional Judaism. The Zionists were largely a minority until World War II. And there was fierce opposition within Jewish circles towards the Zionists. But after World War II and the Holocaust, the Zionists were able to, because of the Holocaust, essentially silence their critics, their Jewish critics, and Zionism became ascendant. And of course, Zionism is quite ruthless and aggressive in terms of shutting down its critics, particularly its Jewish critics. When I covered the war in El Salvador, a Polish doctor, Alina Margolis, who would live in my apartment for about 6 weeks out of the year, and when she worked in the refugee camps as part of Médecins du Monde, which she helped found, she was married to Marek Edelman, who led the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and was the only Jewish commander of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising to survive. And Hannah Krall wrote a great book, Shielding the Flame, interviews with him about it. But she and Marek were Bund. They were not Zionists. They were Jewish socialists. And they began attempting to build an armed resistance movement to the Nazis who had occupied Poland very early. And the Zionists at the beginning tried negotiations and often informed on them. So there was a deep animosity with the Zionists, which was exacerbated in late 1944 when Jewish population in Hungary was about to be deported and at great risk. They actually smuggled someone out of the ghetto to warn the Jewish leadership in Budapest that of the death camps. And what happened was Eichmann flew to Hungary and the wealthy Jews paid exorbitant sums and all left on a train. Everybody else was deported to the death camps and killed. I know from her there was a deep anger towards the Zionist movement, particularly for that instance in Hungary where they sold out the rest of the Jews for their own well-being. Marek and Alina never moved to Israel. They remained in Poland, although Alina, in the anti-Semitic purges of 1968, moved with their kids to Paris. Marek was never honored in Israel because he quite publicly saw in the Palestinians the kind of oppression and suffering that he had endured by the Germans in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he very openly called on or supported not only Palestinian resistance, but armed resistance. That tension between Zionism and Judaism has largely been vanquished because of a very aggressive Zionist and well-funded Zionist movement. But it used to be that there were many, many Jews, and there still are, of course, religious Jews who find or see in Zionism a kind of heretical belief. This is a question from Dave Storfizambo. Do you believe Israel knew that Hamas was going to pull that incursion and allowed it to happen so they could begin the genocide? No. In the same way with 9/11, I think that Bush was asleep at the switch, and I think the Israelis, because of their own hubris and the belief in their technological superiority and their drones and surveillance systems, although there was clear intelligence that something was going to happen, I think if I have it right, they even got a blueprint of a plan. But in their own arrogance, dismissed it. And I think that's very similar to what happened in 9/11. What are your thoughts on the Squad calling the conflict in genocide, in Gaza genocide, but then endorsing and campaigning for Biden. Well, I don't know how you can possibly support a perpetrator of genocide. I don't understand it. I mean, morally, it's utterly indefensible. I don't want Trump, of course, but I mean, at that point, do you have any moral boundaries left? You know, because I spent so many years, 7 years in Palestine and have so many Palestinian friends, I couldn't even broach the topic of voting for Biden. This is Aiden Smith. How should we think about and what should we do in the face of giant tech companies that both perpetuate Israeli apartheid and are so enmeshed with state power that they become difficult targets for the BDS movement? So the BDS movement has not actually achieved its stated goal of getting universities, for instance, to divest, with the exception of a few like Union Theological. But the BDS movement was extremely successful in educating students nationwide into the apartheid regime and the suffering of the Palestinians. And that's why Israel has, and the Zionist lobby has devoted tremendous resources to trying to shut down the BDS movement. Now, as that this live streamed genocide is sort of being openly witnessed by most of the world, if you look, the most of the student activists are calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, first, they're calling for disclosure because these universities don't disclose how they invest and what they do with investments. But it's interesting that the goals of the BDS movement, which I support and have supported from its inception, are being more aggressively put forward in the face of the genocide. So Isaiah, why would Biden risk his reelection for Israel? Well, that's a good question, because Netanyahu is no friend of Biden and is quite happy to sacrifice Biden for Trump, who's even more pliable than Biden. Well, because Biden's a hostage to the Zionist lobby and has been throughout his political career. He received more money from AIPAC than any other senator on record, and he left the Senate, a decade ago to become the vice president. He cannot afford to antagonize the Zionist lobby. Remember, a lot of that, they have a lot of money, and they use it. And so on the one hand, of course, among a significant proportion of younger voters, and even among the Democratic Party, people are revolted, as they should be, at the genocide. But it is hurting him politically. But to sever himself from the Zionist lobby, from AIPAC, is suicidal, especially given our system of legalized bribery, where a presidential candidate has to raise $1 billion in order to run for office. But yeah, Netanyahu would be quite happy to see Biden. That's the irony of it. And of course, they've invited Netanyahu to speak before Congress. And I think they just canceled Netanyahu's visit to the White House. These political figures work for the Zionist lobby, which Netanyahu fully understands. It's the lobby who controls them. They don't control the lobby. Chris, how do you think a group such as Jews that endured genocide in World War II came to commit a genocide of their own only 80 years later? Well, covering war, I saw repeatedly how yesterday's victims instantly become today's victimizers. So the example is the war in Kosovo. I spent all of my time reporting on the atrocities that were being committed by the Serbs against the Kosovo Albanians. And the day the Serbs withdrew, I spent all of my time reporting on the atrocities committed by Kosovo Albanians against ethnic Serbs. This is Primo Levi writes about this very well, that very thin line between the torturer and the tortured. And oftentimes people who have experienced, I think the earlier question raised a good point, trauma or there's a kind of deep lust for vengeance and for carrying out the atrocities that were committed on you against those who perpetrated or carried out those atrocities. I mean, this is, I think, been part of the Palestine-Israel conflict. If there was a kind of sub-theme that all of us who reported out of Gaza kept hitting and year after year, was that you can't brutalize people like this. You can't gun them down as if they're animals and deny them their dignity and their independence and not expect blowback, not expect what we saw on October 7th. So, yes, empowered. I mean, look at the Russian troops, the Soviet troops, once they entered Germany, given the scorched earth policy and massacres that the Nazis had committed on Russian soil. How could you not expect the Soviets to respond in a very similar manner against a German population, even civilian population? So it's a very natural human phenomena. And unfortunately, those who see in their own suffering the suffering of others often have to rise above their own national or ethnic identity in order to do it, because of course those who carried out that perpetrated the genocide, you know, the Germans, I knew I lived in Israel, I knew Israelis who survived the Holocaust who wouldn't even fly over Germany. And Norman Finkelstein speaks about this, and his mother, who was in a death camp, well, both his parents were, going to the trials, I believe it was in Hamburg, and seeing some of the torturers. That's just a kind of sad fact of human nature. This is Dulce Mulvihill. Do you think the Gen X will be as influential for freeing Palestine as the young protesters in the 70s influenced the end of the Vietnam War? Yes, they're the only people who, in my mind, have a conscience in the United States and have been willing to risk their academic careers to stand up for what is right. I don't see any other group in the country doing it. A lot will depend on what happens in the fall. I was up speaking with some of the activists at Columbia University who were talking about calling for nationwide university strikes. So yeah, that's where my hope lies. And I admire their courage and their willingness to stand up when the rest of the society is not. This is from Laura Kaminsky. I heard you talk about Biden and Trump, referring to Trump as a fascist, but not Biden. How is Biden's politely masked fascism less dangerous than crass fascism under Trump? It depends for whom. So if you're a Palestinian, it doesn't really matter whether it's Trump or Biden. If you're one of our nation's incarcerated, and we have 25% of the world's prison population, although we are less than 5% of the world's population, it doesn't make a difference whether it's Biden or Trump. If you are a poor person living in what Malcolm X called our internal colonies, it doesn't make a difference if it's Biden or Trump. But if you're, let's say, part of the liberal democratic elite, or even if you're a journalist, it does make a difference whether it's Trump, and Trump is worse. Trump has the kind of characteristics of a fascist or neo-fascist movement. Biden, the best way to describe Biden is the caretaker. I don't know when, we don't know how cognizant he is most of the day, but the caretaker of what Sheldon Wolin called our system of inverted totalitarianism. Read Sheldon Wolin's book, Democracy Incorporated, and just briefly, inverted totalitarianism is a totalitarian system that retains the facade, the iconography, the language of the democratic state, but internally corporations and the oligarchy control all the levers of power. But it has that facade, much like the late Roman Republic. And so that's different, where fascism will change the symbols. Trump, who doesn't have any real ideology of his own, but he will fill that ideological void with Christian fascism and the iconography and language of Christian fascism. And that's the subject of my book, American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. So there is a difference. And for segments of the population, particularly the liberal elite, Trump will be far, far worse, of course, than Biden. But for many segments of the disenfranchised American population, including the dispossessed working class, and Biden was instrumental in that dispossession, NAFTA, destruction of welfare, the massive increase of the carceral state, that was all Biden and Clinton, it won't make any difference. This is from DK. What advice can you share for those in employment situations where to speak out against Israeli war crimes gets you fired? How can the average Joe support Palestine? So I did a talk a couple years ago with Margaret Atwood in Toronto. And she said something I thought on this point that was really true and interesting. She said, look, Chris and I have a kind of independence that allow us to say things that many of you in your workplace can't say and keep your job. And we fully understand and respect that. And it's our ability to speak out is a kind of privilege, not a way of condemning those who can't speak out. Corporate structures are totalitarian structures, of course. They're hierarchical, very unforgiving of even the mildest expression of politics. And many people work within those systems. But there are things you can do. I mean, for instance, you can boycott Israeli products. Let's start with Starbucks, or corporations that are actively aiding and abetting McDonald's and others. I mean, so there are things in your personal life that you can do that are not insignificant, that can make a difference. But I do think we have to acknowledge that there are people who are constrained by their employment predicaments. And I do think we have to respect that constraint. It's extremely difficult economically, despite all the kind of Potemkin economic indicators that tell us how much employment we have and how wonderful the economy is. It's all fixed and rigged, of course. Michelle Humphrey, do you think the siege of Gaza will hasten the end of American empire? Along with Ukraine, the disastrous fiascos in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, the American empire is stumbling, but it's dying the way all empires do. Arnold Toynbee writes about this. And that is that it engages in increasingly desperate acts of military adventurism to regain a lost hegemony. It's what historians call micromilitarism. So I would say, yes, it's one more piece of the disintegration of the American empire, because of course what it's done, it's clear to the rest of the world that we are full partners in this genocide. And just as Israel has become an international pariah, it has further cemented our status as an international pariah. Blue Wombat, if Netanyahu told Biden to jump off the empire, Biden didn't like Netanyahu. I mean, that's the irony. He's hostage to Netanyahu. Netanyahu actually knew Netanyahu. He was the deputy foreign minister under Moshe Aarons when I lived in Jerusalem. He's a really obnoxious, repellent figure. So no, Biden doesn't like him. I mean, but again, Netanyahu just kind of shoves it in his face. This is Blob Scott. When this is all over, how will society face its complicity? how will we be able to live among one another, those who protested versus those who ignored versus those who were pro this genocide? This is from Adam. Well, as soon as it's over, every society engages in historical amnesia. I saw that in every conflict I covered. Those of us who stood up against the war in Iraq, who I, of course, was pushed out of the New York Times for that, those public statements, are not never rehabilitated. And those who were wrong, the George Packer and Thomas Friedman and Christoph and everyone else, they continue on their with their megaphones provided to them by corporate media because they serve the, because although they were wrong, they serve the interests of those forces and continue to serve those interests. So after any conflict where atrocities are committed or supported, there is an amazing ability by society just to erase it, to whitewash it, to not look at it. I mean, that was true, for instance, in Serbia after the war in Bosnia. What are your thoughts on the prominent right-wing figures such as Candace Owens, Alex Jones, and Tucker Carlson who have come out against American funding of Israel's genocide? Well, I mean, it's that great line from Lord Salisbury, who was a piece of work in his own right, but there are no permanent allies, there's only permanent power. And this was, of course, the organizing tactic used by Saul Alinsky. He would make alliances with anyone on a particular issue. So I can make alliances of anti-militarism with people whose, on many other opinions, I very violently disagree. And I think that that's part of the infantilism of the left, is that it seeks ideological purity. And good organizing tactics don't seek ideological purity, they seek effectiveness. So yeah, on that issue, I have done events with groups on particular issues that I don't agree with. I mean, for instance, I've joined members of the Christian right, who I describe as Christian fascists against pornography. I have joined groups on the left that I don't agree with to protest, especially early on in the war in Iraq. So yeah, on those issues, that means that you can't be silent on the other issues. But that alliances are always shifting in effective organizing. Gray Dove, as a Palestinian American, do you think the Israel-Palestine war will revive the left wing in America, or will the establishment adapt or worsen as seen with Trump? I think the war, the genocide has created a new left-wing movement, because I think, and again, I'll go back to the universities, I think that at least the students I've talked to put it in a much wider context, that they understand that in many ways this isn't just a battle between Israel and the Palestinians, but a battle between the climate fortresses of the industrial north and everyone else, in particular in the global south. There's also an awareness of settler colonial projects and how they work as elite institutions have become more diversified, not diversified enough, of course, but diversified. They have brought in students who are bicultural. So they, you know, their family may live in Sri Lanka and they go back and visit and they, you know, will speak other languages and are fully at home in other cultures. And that's, of course, extremely important in that they have a much deeper understanding of empire and how it works than other students, you know, who come out of, you know, privileged backgrounds and don't travel abroad. And yeah, I think we are seeing, I mean, I'm very heartened by what we see, and I'm very heartened by the sophistication of, and that they see far beyond this as just a Israel-Palestine issue, but they see this as shattering the old global order, the old global domination by Europe and the United States, by the industrial north. James Martin, in one of your speeches, you quote Benito Mussolini said Netanyahu's father was a good fascist. Can you explain the historical context between the new men? No, it wasn't Netanyahu's father. It was Jabotinsky, who Netanyahu's father admired and I think worked for. They founded the Herut Party, which called for the complete ethnic cleansing of Palestine. This was Netanyahu's father. Jabotinsky's interesting and he's worth reading because he's kind of completely frank and open about getting rid of all of the Palestinians on historic Palestine. He doesn't hide it. And it's, of course, racist, those racist tropes. And he had many of that kind of that charismatic, fascistic quality. But it was Jabotinsky that Mussolini was speaking about. You said this week that though Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza, it's accelerating its decline. If this is true, what does it say philosophically about the way oppression works and the way in which karma works as a sort of spiritual enforcer of truth? Well, Israel is exposed for what it is. I don't think there's any going back. I don't think Israel is going to recover that mystique that it once had of the only democracy in the Middle East, which was, of course, always a lie unless you were Jewish, and the heroic army that fought off all the Arab monsters and made flowers bloom in the desert and all this kind of stuff. That's finished. When you build up these forces, Yeshayahu Leibowitz, who Isaiah Berlin called the conscience of Israel, wrote quite pressingly about this, but this was back in the 90s. So when you build up these kind of detention centers and police forces and occupying army, you poison your own democracy, you poison your own society, because all of those forces, tactics, and organizations migrate back to the homeland. And this is, of course, precisely what's happened in the United States. The techniques of control, wholesale surveillance, militarized police, drones, everything that are tested on the outer reaches of empire come back to the disintegrating homeland. It's what Thucydides noted in his great history of the Peloponnesian War, that the tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. So that's what's happening in Israel. And of course, that's what's happening in the United States. Al Laurel, how will the conflict in Gaza read in history books 50 years from now? Well, we'll all be indignant and wring our hands and say never again. And it won't mean anything because we always stand up for moral causes after those causes are terminated or over. But to stand up for a moral issue, to make a moral stance in the moment, is costly. And of course, people will bathe themselves with the moralists of the past, those people with moral courage, but then very rarely replicate that courage in the present. So once it's over, I mean, look, we've got a postage stamp with Malcolm X's face on it. I mean, the state was complicit in the assassination of Malcolm X, clearly. So, but that's because the liberal class is morally bankrupt. So it seeks to posit itself as the moral arbiter within society. And the liberal class is used to go after dissidents, critics. When I opposed the Iraq War, who were those who sought to discredit me? Although I'd spent 7 years in the Middle East, I've been the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, I speak Arabic. They were liberals, Michael Ignatieff, George Packer, et cetera. And Chomsky writes quite presciently about this. He said that they set those moral lines. When you step outside of those moral lines, when you actually begin to critique the system itself, rather than perhaps the excesses of the system, then they must destroy you, because what you're doing is challenging their own position as the moral center of society. Dorothy Graham, U.S. supported UNRWA at $422 million annually, 30% of its budget before U.S. aid was cut off. What's happening to UNRWA now? Is the U.S. redirecting money to other Palestinian aid or just stopping the aid cold? Well, they want to destroy UNRWA. That's long been a goal of Israel. Because it acknowledges the refugee status of Palestinians, number one. And number two, it's a huge operation that essentially provides food and support and medical aid and schooling to Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but in the diaspora and refugee camps in Lebanon and everything else. So the United States, under these false charges, that are certainly been no evidence provided that there were a handful of UNRWA employees who were involved with or supportive or something of the attack of October 7th, they're essentially trying to destroy it. And that's where you have this. That's my, one of my rescue greyhounds. Sorry. You have this fig leaf of World Food Kitchen, which of course is, which now there isn't a pier by which they can even bring food to Gaza. Not that it was ever distributed, but it becomes a kind of fig leaf to, they don't intend to replicate the organization of UNRWA. They can't. It's just part of, it's one more facet of the genocide, one which, of course, a fundamental facet of the genocide is famine, is starvation, coupled with the destruction of the facilities that provide clean water and medical and anything else. Enza Hamilton, why can't the UN use force to protect Palestinians in Gaza? Well, the UN can't use force to protect anyone anywhere unless they're authorized, and there's no authorization on the part of the UN to no one would authorize them to use it. The only people using force to try and protect the people in Gaza are the Yemenis. Are there any significant non-Zionist Jews in Israel? As a Palestinian, I really believe the solution is one state with equal rights, and therefore we need them. Not really. There aren't many anymore. Israel's really changed the death of liberal Zionism, which, I mean, for the Palestinians, it didn't. Liberal Zionists were just as ruthless as religious Zionists, but Israel's changed. It's religious Zionist imprint. Remember when I was in Israel, Meir Kahana, this right-wing religious Zionist rabbis, they blocked, the liberal Zionists banned the Koch party, and he was eventually assassinated. Now it's the triumph of liberal Zionism, which in some way is more honest. But no, I think Israel has become the handful of voices, Gideon Levy, who I'll interview, and Amir Haas, they're really now outliers within Israel. In terms of, no, there's no two-state solution. Israel's destroyed the capacity for a two-state solution. That's over. I mean, I don't see how we could possibly have a two-state solution after what's happened in Gaza and what's happening in the West Bank, the brutality that's happening in the West Bank. With regard to Jared Kushner's comments on Gaza's waterfront property being very valuable, how much of this genocide is a capitalist imperialist ploy to gain resources from the Gaza Strip, and how much of it is plain hatred towards Palestinians? Well, it's probably both. Remember, there are gas fields off of Gaza. I mean, they always go hand in hand. Let's not forget the massive amounts of money the weapons industry, the American weapons industry, is making off of the genocide, along with the fiasco in Ukraine, which is, I mean, the weapons industry is drives so much of foreign policy. It doesn't make any sense to do it, but profit. I mean, we know from the Afghan papers that were published by the Washington Post that years before we were humiliated and forced out of Afghanistan, the American planners knew the war was unwinnable, but there was a lot of money to be made, just as there's a lot of money to be made in Ukraine. There's a lot of money to be made in Gaza. Unfortunately, that drives policy, but that policy is often detrimental to the health of the empire itself. What purpose have the arts served historically to combat atrocities such as the genocide in Gaza? Well, the arts are key always in any revolutionary movement. When I covered the war in Salvador, the FMLN rebels would occupy a town, and one of the first things they do is bring in their theater group. What is Emma Goldman said, you know, poetry, art, music, it gives emotion to ideas. The arts are important, and Palestinian artists have been at the forefront of this. Loki, the great British rapper, was a friend of mine. He tried to do a tour in the U.S. and he was denied a visa because filling a concert hall with his anthems, you know, "What is a Terrorist" and "Free Palestine." The United States authorities were very aware of how effective and potent art is, and he is. He's an amazing guy. So we'll do one more question. How is it that Zionism has such a stranglehold on U.S. media, politics, and corporate power? Money, money, money. They control the political system through money. They are essentially able to use that money to buy up media, or in terms of advertising, to threaten a withdrawal of advertising that would harm the media. So that's it. I mean, we live in a unfortunately in a system where an oligarchic system where there is no check on the rapacious desires of the billionaire class, and the Zionist lobby has very, very, very deep pockets, and they will punish you whether you are running for office. I mean, of course, they will give you money if you spout the Zionist line. If you don't, they will spend money to defeat you, and they have an ability to cripple you in terms of advertising. So yeah, it is. It's a very pernicious force, and everyone should watch The Lobby, which was done by Al Jazeera, where this very courageous Jewish British student worked inside the lobby with a hidden camera. That segment that he did in the UK was broadcast. The segment he did in the US was blocked on Al Jazeera. It never was broadcast. Electronic Intifada and a few other sites got a pirated copy. But boy, you can see why they wanted to block it, because it made very clear how they owned the political class and owned much of the media. And there was just no disputing it because it was filmed and it was in their words. So thanks. We will begin, as I said at the beginning, our regular programming, weekly programming, resurrecting the show I had on The Real News and before that on RT. Primarily books, and I have a stack of books which I went through at the beginning. We've already contacted those authors. It's what takes the time for my show is the prep time, because I read the books. So we won't start filming until the end of July, because I need a month to get through all the material, and then hopefully those shows, as they did before, will come out every week. But thank you so much for joining us.